Okay, we are continuing our kind of perforated series is what it's turned out to be, because I was gone for 2 weeks, then I came back, and then we didn't meet last week because of a church meeting. So, but we've been looking at this whole notion of this idea that I introduced back in September, that we are homeopathies. We are men and women of like nature with the people that are in the scriptures. That's what James says about Elijah. And we had worked our way through looking at different characters, each time trying to find some point of connection, either something to emulate or something to avoid or something to get rid of in case it's already found its way into our mental and spiritual furniture. So we're going to go back and take a look at what we did 2 weeks ago and just kind of cruise over the top of it. And I've got a few pieces of thoughts on this that were not in your notes. But last time we did this study on Saul of Tarsus, who had become the Apostle Paul. And one of the things that wasn't in your notes because we didn't talk about it, but it's become something that my blood pressure goes up talking about it. I get so excited about it. Is this idea that life really needs to have a plot in order for there to be any kind of meaning or purpose. And if there's no ultimate plot, then there can be no personal meaning. All right? You can get no sense of meaning out of randomness. There has to be something in our minds that we really believe that life is moving in some direction, that it has a beginning and that it has an end. So it's linear, and that my life fits on that line. Matter of fact, if I don't think of it that way, I end up having an emptiness in my life. That's probably part of the reason why many believers, when they hit middle age, fall apart. Their relationships fall apart, their careers fall apart, their marriages fall apart, because they don't have a genuine sense of purpose, all right? Because they've tried to live their life apart from the divine narrative, all right? So the idea of plot is really, really important. And Paul came to realize that what he thought was his story, kind of his plot, his storyline, wasn't big enough to contain the one story of the one God. He got so blown away by God's revelation of this narrative, of this story, of this plot, that he said that God had to give him a thorn in the flesh to keep him from becoming conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations that God had shown him. And God just exploded Paul's whole view of what life was all about. We looked at that last week. Choose your own adventure. It's interesting to me that I don't believe there's any other culture on the planet that has a choose your own adventure genre for literature except America. There's 24 endings for the book, The Abominable Snowman. And people, sometimes, even Christians, take that same approach to life, the Christian life. You know, I kind of got saved when I was 7, so, and I'm going to go to heaven when I die. What do you do in the meantime? Well, you choose your own adventure, just so you're moral. You know, you be good and don't do anything bad, and God leaves it open to you. That is a denial, beloved, of this whole notion that God has a plan for the fullness of time to unite all things in heaven and things on earth in Christ. And so this is not an option for you and I as a believer, all right? Last thing for us is I need to really find my place in his story rather than trying to find him a place in my story. Every one of us, when we stand before the Lord, we're going to want to have him say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." But the only reasonable thing I could ever say to God that would cause him to say that is, "I finished the work that you gave me to do. I completed my role in your story," and God would say, "Well done, thou good and faithful servant." So that's kind of what we were looking at last week. It's a little bit bigger this week than... All right, we're going to take a look at Jezebel tonight. This is the first time ever in my entire life that I've ever taught this. So I'm pretty sure that all this stuff is true, okay? I mean, I worked on this a lot, and I've prayed over it, and I've researched it, and I've studied it, and because it really teaches well, so I'm hoping that it's really true. No, I believe it is. I just said that.
You're writing your own story.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, this is a choose your own adventure with Jezebel as the key star. So it'll have a teen rating for sure. I want to just read a little bit to you from the book of 1 Kings. This is where she's mentioned the most. There's a 1,000-year gap between the last mention of her and the last mention of her in our Old Testament and the mention of her in the book of Revelation. And her reputation has not changed in 1,000 years. So, and for some of the graphics on this, I go online to get all these visuals and stuff. I have a thing called Covenant Eyes. Some of you men are probably involved in that. But it's a thing on my computer that sends a report to 3 other people of every website I've visited in the course of the week. So I can go wherever I want, but I can't go by myself. And I think I just blew the lid off my Covenant Eyes report looking for visuals on Jezebel, because there's no really good ones out there, including the magazine by that title. All right. Let me read just a couple. We're going to jump around. We're going to talk a little bit about Ahab and Jezebel when they first kind of get connected, and then we're going to jump into her relationship with Elijah, and then we're going to jump a little bit further to a little story about a guy named Naboth, who had a vineyard that her husband wanted for a vegetable garden. All right, so I'm going to jump around. This is just 2 or 3 verses in chapter 16, verses 29 through 31. In the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, the son of Omri, began to reign over Israel, and Ahab, the son of Omri, reigned over Israel and Samaria 22 years. And Ahab, the son of Omri, did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. And as if it had been a light thing for him to walk in the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, he took for his wife Jezebel, the daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and went and served Baal and worshipped him. And then chapter 19, after the contest on Mount Carmel, where Elijah kind of goes head-to-head with the prophets of Baal and the prophets of Asherah, the priests of Baal and the priests of Asherah, and he kills them all. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he arose and ran for his life and came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. And then the last one is in chapter 21 of 1 Kings, starting with verse 4. Ahab went into his house vexed. He had asked this guy for his garden. And sullen because of what Naboth the Jezreelite had said to him. For he had said, "I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers." And Ahab lay down on his bed and turned away his face and would not eat any food. He's depressed. But Jezebel, his wife, came to him and said to him, "Why is your spirit so vexed that you eat no food?" And he said to her, "Because I spoke to Naboth the Jezreelite and said to him, 'Give me your vineyard for money, or else if it will please you, I will give you another vineyard for it.' And he answered, 'I will not give you my vineyard.' And Jezebel, his wife, said to him, Do you now govern Israel? Arise and eat bread and let your heart be cheerful. I will give you the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite." So she wrote letters in Ahab's name and sealed them with his seal. And she sent the letters to the elders and the leaders who lived with Naboth in his city. And she wrote in the letters, quote, "Proclaim a fast and set Naboth at the head of the people and set 2 worthless men opposite him and let them bring a charge against him saying, 'You have cursed God and the king.' Then take him out and stone him to death." And the men of his city, the elders and the leaders who lived in his city, did as Jezebel had sent word to them. As it was written in the letters that she had sent to them, they proclaimed a fast, set Naboth at the head of the people, and the 2 worthless men came in and sat opposite him, and the worthless men brought a charge against Naboth in the presence of the people, saying, "Naboth cursed God and the king." They took him outside the city, stoned him to death with stones. Then they sent to Jezebel, saying, "Naboth has been stoned, and he is dead." As soon as Jezebel heard that Naboth had been stoned and was dead, Jezebel said to Ahab, "Arise, take possession of the vineyard of Naboth the Jezreelite, which he refused to give you for money. He is no longer alive. He is dead." Those are kind of the 3 main stories that Jezebel has a key part in. There's a bunch more, all right? But we're gonna work our way through this the same way we've done before. We're going to spend a little bit more time than normal on this stuff having to do with what's behind the text. We're going to look at the text that we looked at, but also I need to tell you ahead of time, I was talking with some friends at dinner tonight, this is not going to end up being a lesson about a woman, all right? So if you're a woman sitting here and think, here we go again, all right? Or if you're a guy sitting here thinking, yeah, here we go, all right? It's not going to happen, all right? This one, I have to tell you up front, this stuff that we're going to look at tonight is absolutely heavy. All right, this is a heavy topic. Because people like Jezebel, we think there's no way that we are homeopathies with someone like her. We are not a person of like passion with Jezebel. All right, and before the night is over, we are all going to be in the same pot, and it's going to be cooking, and the heat's going to be up. So we're going to go and take a look at a little bit of work on the world behind the text, some history and some culture, all right? And I want to try to have us understand what was going on between these two nations, all right? Phoenicia is where Jezebel came from, all right? If we were to, this is a kind of an instant map of the Holy Land, all right? And Phoenicia is right about up here, and Samaria is right about here. This is the Dead Sea. It actually doesn't look like that anymore. It kind of goes like this. It's in two bodies of water because the Jordan doesn't get there anymore. All the water is sucked off for irrigation. All right, but it's in the northwestern coast of what we would call the Holy Land, kind of where Lebanon and Syria come together up there now. And we're going to take a look at, there's some things they have in common, both of those countries, and in terms of their history. All right, that's actually the map right there. Phoenicia is right here. All right, and Samaria is right there. Samaria is just a city. By the time we get to Jesus' day, it's a whole region. And the city has been long gone. All right, in 722, this is about 850 or so BC, about 130 years later, the Assyrians come in and just level the northern kingdom and haul off 10 tribes, and they never, ever come back. And that's kind of where the Samaritans came from that. But I want us to take a look at these two nations, and I want us to have a sober realization of the folly of putting our hope as Christians in the political process. All right? Chuck Colson wrote a book called Kingdoms in Conflict quite a few years ago. And in the first chapter of the book, he talked about the Christian mistake of either deifying politics, having such a confidence in politics, they either deify politics or else they have just a reduced understanding of God's sovereignty. All right? Don't get me wrong, it's the wrong time in history to sound un-American. I'm glad I was born here and I'm proud to be an American, but my hope is not in the political system, democratic or socialistic or any other kind. And you see this here because of some things that happened. And I want us to kind of go through this, all right? First one is around 1000 BC. What's that? Well, that's roughly David, Solomon are kind of in there, all right? About 1000 BC, there's a strong economic and political alliance based on mutual goals, which were expansion and wealth. Between what? Between Phoenicia and Israel, all right? Between Phoenicia and Israel, there was a strong national alliance based on common national goals, which was accumulation of wealth and the expansion, all right? This is the time of David and Solomon. You're probably familiar with this if you've read 2 Samuel or if you've read 1 Kings or both of those books, and again 2 Chronicles. You find out Hiram is the king of Tyre, which is just up the coast. It's part of Phoenicia. Tyre and Sidon are the two major cities in this area. Hiram built David's palace. And Hiram brought his stone cutters and his carpenters and his stonemasons down to Jerusalem. After David conquered Jerusalem and made it his capital city, he floated all kinds of the cedars of Lebanon. He floated those down the coast to Joppa, and they hauled them inland about 30 miles, and they built his palace for King David. And David wanted to build a temple, didn't he? And God said no, but Hiram is the guy that built the temple in Jerusalem. He was the guy that basically Solomon used. And Solomon and Hiram developed an amazing relationship. All right. Hiram sent his shipbuilders down to the Red Sea to the Gibeonizer there. And the Israelites built ships. This is unheard of. Jews were afraid of water. They were scared spitless of the ocean. All right. And so they build these ships, and then you read in 1 Kings that Solomon brought back the gold of Ophir, and he brought back peacocks and apes and all this crazy stuff. He developed an amazing merchant marine system. All right. So what you had is that you ended up having the best of both worlds. Hiram lived on the coast, and the only place they could expand was out into over into Greece, into Cyprus, and a few other places, down to Egypt. But the Jews were inland, and so they had the land trade routes. So you got Hiram benefiting. Now he can start doing trade inland, and you got the Jews are able to do trade out into the seas. And so there's this great, great working relationship between these two places. All right. But by 900 BC, all right, now just for those of you that have been through my Old Testament class, 931 BC is a very, very important date in the Old Testament. All right. 931, this is not in your notes. 931 BC is when Rehoboam, Solomon's son, made that stupid mistake of listening to his fraternity buddies instead of listening to the older prime ministers of war that had grown old with his dad, Solomon. And he just listened to all of his college buddies, basically, that he'd grown up with. And he said, I'm going to be tougher than Solomon. And Solomon was awful. People hated Solomon. All right. And he said, I'm going to be worse than my father. And the nation split. That's when the nation split, 931. 10 tribes to the north, 2 tribes to the south. So we're about 30 years on the other side of that later, all right? Israel's now divided, and the paganized northern kingdom is ruled by a powerful world player, all right? And his name is Omri. Omri is a really, really important guy in world history. And I'll show you some things about it in a minute. All right. So what we're seeing now, we started out with this wonderful political and economic alliance between these two countries. One is obviously the kingdom of the Jews. The other one is as pagan as it gets. All right. Hiram was pagan. And I'll show you what I mean in a minute. All right. But they worked together. All right. They locked arms for economic and political affiliation, all right? But it starts to deteriorate. This United Kingdom under David and Solomon is now split into a Northern Kingdom and a Southern Kingdom. Northern Kingdom has 19 kings over about 250 years, and every single one of them is bad, okay? The Southern Kingdom has about 20 kings. It lasts a little bit longer, and most of them are bad as well, not as many, all right? But by the time we get to 875, and we're just about the time we're getting to Ahab, Phoenicia is ruled now. It's ruled. The king of Phoenicia, all right, is a priest of Asherah, who is the consort of Baal. She's a female deity, goddess of sensuality and fertility, and Baal is kind of her husband, all right? And I am not gonna get into this. I can't, for proper reasons. Baal worship was the most perverted, twisted, sexually messed up cultic activity in the ancient Near East. The literature itself is awful. And the practices that went along with it were awful too. All right. But by this time now, we started out with this beautiful alliance between two nations, and because one of them already was pagan and the other one went that direction, we end up with something really, really bad that's about to take place. This is like the perfect storm that started out being the perfect calm. All right? And the Phoenician influence, the pagan Phoenician influence of Tyre and Sidon, particularly the relationship that they had with Baal, that god, had been held in check by righteous kings. Solomon started out really good. He ended awful. But David, we know, was a man after God's own heart. And so David was able to do business with Hiram, but Hiram's religious and cultural influence didn't touch David. It started to mess with Solomon. We know that Solomon starts out his reign. You guys know that story about the baby, that two moms were arguing over the baby, and Solomon says, cut the baby in half and give them each half, knowing that the real mother would say, give her to the other woman, give her to the other woman, which is a cool thing. Well, by the time he gets to the end of his reign, he's building shrines for Moloch in the valley of Hinnom outside the city, and their babies are being burned on the arms of these brazen statues that they build fires in their hollow. And so he really went off the dark side, all right? But up until that time, Baal had minimal influence among God's people because of the leadership, okay? And I want to just let you know something here, all right? Hiram's name means son of the lofty one, and I don't think it's Yahweh, all right? His father's name, Hiram's father's name, was Abba Baal, all right? Abba Baal means Baal is my father, all right? Jezebel, her name means Baal is prince, all right? Her father's name was Ethbaal. Are you kind of seeing a pattern here? Ethbaal, which means, it's got, I forget what that one means, but it's Baal's in all of these names, and they're all coming from the same area, all right? So this is not something that she cooked up. It had been there a long time. It had been kept at a distance because of the righteousness of the kings of God, God's people, and that began to fall apart about 931, and by the time we get to Ahab, we've got a mess on our hands, all right? Now, when we get to Ahab, you know, this is not a lesson in power, it's a lesion of power, it's a wound. It's an infection of power, all right? And I want to go back and let you see some things, because Jezebel gets all the bad press here, and rightfully so, all right? And Ahab kind of just comes across as this mamby-pamby, manic depressive, kind of spoiled little guy that can't get the vineyard he wants, and he goes and stares at the wall and won't eat, you know, kind of like stuff you've done. If you've raised kids, you know they do this sort of things, all right? So we kind of think of him as a junior high kind of spoiled little guy that can't get something, all right? And it's bigger than that. I want to paint a picture for you to understand Ahab, and then when we mix in Jezebel, we're going to see something insidious, all right? Ahab comes from an amazing family. Ahab's father was known for his wickedness and his power. His name was Omri. His conquest of Moab in the south, all right, Moab was down kind of down near the Dead Sea, is memorialized in a stone that's in the London Museum. It's called the Mesha Stone. Mesha was the king of Moab, all right? This is what it looks like. I mean, it's a huge, they call it a stele, but it's a huge chunk of black basalt. And carved in there is the fact that Omri had come against the king of Moab. And there's not a lot of Jewish kings' names that are etched in stone. All right? We don't have a lot of mention of Jewish history outside our Bible. And this is one of the most amazing records showing that Omri was a powerful, powerful king. All right? 100 years later, after he's dead, the Assyrians are still calling Israel Omri land. Not Opry land, right? Omri land. Omri land's more like Jurassic Park, all right, than Opry land. And they so valued his military prowess and his military history that the Assyrians, 100 years later, this guy is still known. This is his father. This is Ahab's dad, all right? And the scripture said he was more wicked than all the kings before him. Well, there was only 5 kings before him. But still, he was the most wicked of those 6 kings. Omri was. All right, now file that away. That's the home he grew up in. All right. Ahab's wickedness, I want you to get this, because I think this is important, was enhanced by Jezebel. It wasn't created by it. All right. political alliance aside and all that sort of stuff that went on in medieval times and ancient Near Eastern times, where two nations, kings would put their sons and daughters together to make a political alliance to make the nation stronger. That was all going on, don't get me wrong. But Ahab was already wicked before he even married Jezebel, all right? He's described in the Bible as more wicked than Omri. Where do I get that? I get it from the statement that says that Ahab did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than all the kings before him. That's including his father. So he just went from the number two spot to the number one spot in God's most wanted. Okay? But it's his wickedness that's used as the starting reference point just to bring Jezebel into the story. Did you get that? It says that he was more wicked than all the kings that came before him. Right? Now, let me just clarify one other thing, because I like to do stuff like this. Well, I checked the 12 kings that came after him, went through every bit of the scriptures on the 12 kings that came after him, and that was never said about another king. Which means that Ahab was the worst of all 19 of them. Because no one was ever given the attribution, he did more evil than all the kings before him after Ahab. All right? And it says that he was more wicked than all the kings before him. Then it says, and if this was a light matter, then he went and married Jezebel. All right? So she kind of just gets brought into the story on his coattails. All right? He was already evil. He was already obsessed with power. And he also was also highly successful as a military commander. Shalmaneser III, all right? He's the son of Assur... Well, never mind. No, I know what it is, but my brain won't say it. Ashurnasirpal. Ashurnasirpal is his father, all right? But he, the Syrian king, Shalmaneser III, all right, he's not in our Bible. His son, Shalmaneser IV, is in our Bible. Shalmaneser III makes an attack on Israel, on the east, all right, the west. And so 12 kings from as far away as eastern Greece, they make an alliance and they all fight him. And they really give him a rout for a while, but then he just kicks their tail, all right? Well, Syrians were really big about remembering their military conquest, all right? So there's another one of these statues called the Monolith inscription, and on it says this, and he's talking about Ahab. Look at this, 2,000 chariots. Those are, when you read the word chariot in the Bible, think tank. Think tank, that's a tank, all right? 2,000 chariots, 10,000 soldiers belonging to Ahab the Israelite, all right? I battled with them, and this is now he's talking about all 12 kingdoms. I routed them from Karkar, this is called the Battle of Karkar, 853, they read about it in the history books, to the city of Silzu, killing 14,000 of their soldiers, raining destruction on them like Adad. I scattered their bodies far and wide, and I covered the face of the desolate plain with their vast armies. He lists on this inscription, he lists he counts all the chariots and all the soldiers and all the cavalry of all 12 armies. And Ahab's is second in terms of influence. All right, so this guy is a key player as well, big enough to make it into, you know, Shalmaneser III's little, not little, big thing. All right, so he's a big guy. We kind of tend to skip over Ahab and get right to Jezebel. All right, but I want you to understand that Ahab came out of a family of power and corruption, and Ahab was more powerful, more corrupt, more wicked, and more evil than any of the kings that preceded him and any that came after him. Then he married Jezebel. All right. So if you're a Jew living in the northern territories, this is not good. All right. This is not like the Shriners coming to town. This is bad. All right. This is real bad. All right. Now, Jezebel, this is going to surprise you that I put this in here. Jezebel has more integrity than Ahab. You might not think of her as having integrity. Integrity is this. Integrity is an internal compass by which a person lives consistently with their convictions. That's what integrity is. And she does. You know, we get really bent out of shape when unbelievers are really consistent and live like unbelievers. All right? I mean, I used to have to constantly, if you've got small kids, you need to help them understand this. Christian young people have a real difficult time because sometimes as Christian parents, we don't help them understand that that's the way unbelievers are supposed to act. You know, we were, Ben and I, when Ben was about 7 years old, we were in Colorado Springs. I was teaching there. We pulled out of this parking lot, and this guy came flying by in a, some of you can remember, it was a Datsun B210. It was one of the ugliest cars ever made next to the Gremlin. I think it was just awful. All right, and this guy had about 30 different colors of paint on it. It looked like it should have been in a hunting cabin. I didn't see it, all right? And so I pulled out, and I almost hit this guy, and he started yelling and waving at me. Not his whole hand, but just part of it. And he, and my son said, "What's wrong with that guy?" Ben said, "What's wrong with that guy?" Now, that would have been a perfect opportunity for me to talk about the fact that he was an idiot and this sort of stuff. And what I did, and I'm telling you honestly, as God is my witness, this happened like twice in parenting, so don't think I did this all the time and I was the perfect parent, all right? But I started talking to him about Genesis 3. I started talking to him about the fall. I started talking to him about sin and sin nature. And I basically just said, "Ben," I said, we're all inclined to do that. I said, "If it wasn't for Jesus in your dad's life, I'd be just like that person," all right? And I think sometimes when we look at people, we don't, and I'm not saying we need to excuse any behavior, but we need to be careful that we don't put Christian standards on people that aren't Christians. We need to put Christian standards on people that are Christians, all right? But she had more integrity than Ahab. What do I mean by that? Number one, her behavior, how she acted, was consistent with her religion and her worldview. It wasn't a deviation from it like Ahab's. Ahab had been raised up in a culture that had the law and the word of God. They had the priesthood. They had a temple in Jerusalem. They had a history that went all the way back to Moses and beyond. All right, and it was of the highest ethical standards. If you talk to really smart people that study this stuff, they will tell you that the writings, the Hebrew writings, are of the highest ethical character of anything in the ancient Near East in terms of what they expect from people and what they call out of people. She was just living out her worldview, and it was totally consistent with what the way she was living. All right. Second, her narcissistic manipulation, her selfishness, and the way she twisted and played with people was a product of her spirituality, not a violation of it. It was a violation of Judaism for Ahab to do what he did. This is perfectly consistent with Baal worship, all right? You negotiated with Baal. You know, if we had a drought and you need some rain, you kill your son, you do something, you bargain with them. And the whole thinking in Canaanite worship was that you can get the gods to do what you want by virtue of what you do down here. They have to do in heaven what you and I reenact down here. So she's just being internally consistent, all right? It was an evil, selfish, manipulative religious system, and she was a product of it, and she's just living it out. Ahab, on the other hand, was a violation of everything that was in their history, even though it had gotten twisted. All right, now, let's take a look at a couple passages and some ideas in here. I want to go in and I want to spend some time looking at, I put down here two sorority sisters. Now, if you've been in a sorority, I was in a fraternity. I hope that doesn't offend you. These Eve and Jezebel have something in common. They kind of hang out together, all right, in some ways. And we talked about Eve, we talked about Adam, and I want to go and spend some time. And what they have in common has to do with what happened in the garden in Genesis 3. And Satan has an MO. He has a modus operandi. He has a way of doing things, and it has not changed. It's power and control. Power and control. All right, now I'm going to say this, and I'm going to say it slowly, and I'll try to say it as sensitively and tenderly as I can, but power and control in the life of a believer are demonic. It's not just a problem we might have. They're demonic. They are at the heart of who Satan is, all right? And we're going to go back and look at that, all right? It's what he coveted for himself and still covets. We get that from the book of Isaiah. If you read in Isaiah, Isaiah said in 14, he's talking about Satan. There's the king of Tyre, but it's really a cryptic reference to the enemy. "I will ascend the mount of the Most High. I will be like God." And God said, "You're going to be cast down to Sheol." But Satan covets power and control. Power and control. That's what he operates out of. It's what he offered to Eve, isn't it? He said to Eve, he said, you will be like God if you eat this. God's lying to you. He doesn't want you to be like him. You will be like God. And beloved, we talked about this when we did the lesson on Adam. There is a part of us that we have this Adamic remnant. We have this Adamic residue in us that loves power and loves control. And we, left to ourselves, we move in that direction. All right? We'll talk about that a little bit more here. It's what he offered Jesus, isn't it? Of the three temptations, he asked him to turn stone into bread, and he asked him to jump off the temple. But the one in the middle, he said, look at all these kingdoms. You worship me, and I'll give them to you. Power and control, same thing. He hasn't taken that offer off the table. It's still on the table for anyone that wants it. Jezebel took it. She took it. But the struggle for power and control is also the lifelong battle of every one of us. As long as we are in this skin, this side of eternity, and you see this all throughout the scriptures. You see it in the Gospels. The disciples, what were they constantly arguing about when Jesus wasn't around? Who's the greatest? Who's the greatest? All right? They even had one of their mothers. You know, this reminded me of being a high school teacher at Briarwood. But they had this mom that came in and said, I have something I want to ask you, Jesus. And he said, what's that? He said, I want my two boys, James and John, I want one at your right and one at your left. Remember that story? I mean, she's posturing for power and control. Ananias in the book of Acts. All right? He's trying to have a sense of status in the church by telling the church, tells Peter, we sold this property and we gave all the money to the church. And he says, why did you lie to God? You could have kept it for yourself. You did not need to give it away. You could have given part of it, but you made a statement, public statement, that this is all, we're giving this all for God. The clearest passage is in Colossians chapter 3, verse 5, where Paul makes the statement, and we talked about this a little bit when we talked about Adam. But in Colossians 3, 5, Paul says, put to death, therefore, that which is earthly in you. All right, and he starts to list the things that go according to this. Sexual immorality, impurity, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. And so this, beloved, is a struggle for me. It's a struggle for you, all right? When we operate, and I'm going to spend a little time on this. I'd love to spend more time on this, but we can't. When you and I operate from the standpoint of our Adamic or our Edenic residue, the part of us that we said at the very beginning that loves sin and hates God. When we operate on that level, we're operating on what I would call an instinctual level. All right? And for men who operate on that level, the way they pursue power and control, oftentimes for men, is through intimidation, through subjugation, domination. You see it in sports. You see it with men that abuse their children and their wives. I mean, what causes a grown man to strike a child? What causes a grown man to strike a woman? All right, power and control. Using the design, the bigger frame, the louder lungs, the bigger heart, and all that sort of stuff that characterizes the men on an instinctual level, on an Adamic level, when they're pursuing power and control, it tends to become abusive. And if you read the scriptures, the New Testament, Paul's instructions to men, every time, without exception, to men who are in a relationship of a superior subordinate, he addresses this issue. Every time. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Husbands, do not be harsh with your wives. Masters, do not threaten your slaves. He goes after that, all right? In the Old Testament, the instructions to men in the Old Testament have to do with dealing with women who use their design for power and control. And it all has to do with enticement and seduction. The way they walk, the way they dress, and all this sort of stuff. You know, and we have to be really, really careful, because the way of Jesus, The way of Jesus is always sacrifice and service. He's always moving us in the direction of sacrifice and service. The way of Adam, the way of Jezebel, the way of Eve, the way of Satan himself is power and control. It's always power and control. And it's something that we have to be aware of because it's inherent in us. Okay? Now, if we take a look at these two ladies, Jezebel and Eve, all right? Some things that I want to point out about Jezebel, all right? And this is going to get a little close to home for us in the church. And by us, I mean all of us. This is how Jezebel, I think, shows up within the family of God, all right? One of the things that Jezebel did, if you look at her, the first thing she did was she got rid of the contrary voices. She killed all the prophets of God. She thought she did, all right? A guy named Obadiah had hid a bunch of them in a cave. But one of the things that happens oftentimes among Christians, I saw this in Christian schools, I see it in churches, I teach in a lot of churches, and I've watched this happen, is that people who raise a contrary voice oftentimes are either driven out of a church. I know pastors that have just told people, you need to go someplace else because this is what we're doing here. All right, we need to be careful that we don't silence voices in our midst as a group of believers or as individuals or as a family for that matter, all right, that are contrary. She did that. She got rid of any voice that would speak of monotheism, that would speak of Yahweh, she tried to get rid of. Her goal was to bring Baal worship and make it pretty much the national worship of the Northern Kingdom, and she succeeded. It was really this marriage and the bringing of Baal into the Northern Kingdom that set the dominoes in motion that brought on the Assyrian conquest. Basically, God said, I can't fix this. Second thing she did was she understood the strategy or the power of strategic giving. And I put giving in quotes. What did she do? Jezebel had 450 prophets of Baal and 450 prophets of Asherah that ate at her table. And in a sense, she provided for them their living, which almost in a sense bought them off in terms of being a contrary voice or ever challenging her and doing everything that she wanted to do. So on one hand, she silenced the prophets of Yahweh, the real prophets, by killing them. And then she put money into the lives of these people by giving to them, creating in a very sense an obligatory sense of indebtedness to her. She bought them off in a very real sense. We can do this sometimes if we're not careful with how we give to organizations, to individuals, and so on. Third thing, she understood the power of influential people. Jezebel wrote those letters and gave them to the elders and the leaders of Jezreel, where Naboth lived. And she said, I want you to do this. And when people of influence take a stand, people who of lesser influence tend to follow suit. Fourth thing that she did was that she understood the power of intimidation. That's what she used even with Elijah. She said to Elijah, the gods do so to me and even more if by this time tomorrow I haven't hung your hide on the garage wall. And it says Elijah ran for his life. He was afraid. Now, this is the guy that had just been at the top of Mount Carmel. And Elijah was no small cookie when it came to the plan of God. Now, this is the last point, and I think this is important. She became despotic. She became a despot, all right, by rejecting the prophetic. And I'm not sure if you've been taught this before, but it's a really important principle to understand about the Old Testament. In a theocracy, the Old Testament, where God is ruling over a group of people, the most important people, the most powerful individuals in a theocracy are the prophets. The prophet's job is to keep the king walking in line with the covenant stipulations. The responsibility of the king is to lead the nation in covenant faithfulness. And when the king started to get away from being faithful to Yahweh, God raised up the prophets. and their job. You read them from start to finish. Isaiah, Jeremiah, every one of them, their job is almost always, the message is almost always to the king. Get back on track. Get back on track. If you go back to last week's lesson, I love to think of it this way. The prophets were always trying to deal with the traitors in the story. They're trying to get God's people back into the storyline, his plan for the fullness of time. And they'd raise up prophets to call out the traitors, okay? And then they also provided what I call trailers. You know, trailers for a movie, how they call it a trailer where you get to see a preview of a movie that's coming. That's what predictive prophecy is in the Old Testament. God gives them a little hint of what's coming down the road in the story to provide them with hope right now. And then he also uses the prophets to get in the faces of God's people to tell them the truth about getting back into the story where it belongs. But she gave that up. She refused to listen to the prophetic voice. And I think sometimes we, as believers in America, sometimes we have the same tendency. All right? And I will say this without apology, because I mean, I'd die for this. That's how much I believe it's true. The prophetic voice from the people of God belongs back in the church, not the culture. It is not the role of the church to be telling the culture what's wrong with it. The role of prophets is to help us stay on track, help us get back into the story. All right. So this is this stuff that's in Jezebel's life. This idea of being a person of getting influential people to follow her party line, investing money in people so that they won't contradict her, getting rid of the conflicting voices, and intimidating people simply because she has the power or the position to do so. We have some of that stuff in our own midst, and may even have it in our own lives. All right, so if we start to take all this together, let me show you three things that I think we can ask ourselves. Three questions, all right? Trying to learn how to be Jehu, all right? Who's Jehu? Jehu's the guy that threw Jezebel out the window, all right? He comes riding into town, and she's got herself all painted up and all this sort of stuff, and she accuses him of being Zimri, who's the guy that killed Omri. And he basically says, who's with me? If you're with me, throw her down. And they just push her out of the window, and she gets eaten by dogs. You guys know this story. But sometimes we need to be Jehu in getting Jezebel out of our lives. We need to push her out of the window of our own lives. And so let's look at three questions that have to do with this notion. Number one is this. Jesus said that greatness is measured by service, not by servants. What do I mean by that? It's not by how many people are working under me or are afraid of me or are doing things for me. It's by how much I'm serving others. All right? A very powerful, powerful truth that Jesus teaches over and over and over. Probably the best example of it is in Mark's gospel. He says, you know that those who are considered rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them, and their great ones exercise authority over them. But it shall not be so among you, for whoever would be great among you must be your servant, and whoever would be first among you must be slave of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus, and this does not sit well in our culture, but Jesus almost always operates out of the place of weakness and the position of weakness rather than out of strength and majesty and all this sort of stuff. That day's coming. That day is coming. I mean, he's going to come back on a white horse, but he came into Jerusalem on a donkey. And we are, I think, asked to do the same. All right. So the question for you and I is, how do I spell success? When I think of success for myself or for those that I love, children, grandchildren, whatever, what goes through my mind? Do I measure it in terms of greatness, or do I measure it in terms of service? And one of the things that's really encouraging me as I came back from the Upper Midwest, I've addressed nearly 1,000 college students from 25 different universities in the last 5 weeks. And beloved, there is a movement of God among the rising generation that wants to go to the nations, that wants to spill their lives for Jesus, like I have not seen in 35 years. I mean, I'm more encouraged now than I've ever been, all right? Because they have redefined success in terms of kingdom values rather than the typical values that we have in our own culture. So this is one way that we can throw Jezebel out the window. Second one, Jesus said that godly giving is measured by secrecy, not supremacy. What do I mean by that? I simply mean that Jesus doesn't ever want us to use the giving that we give, whether it's to churches or organizations, as a means of manipulation and control and power. He wants us to give secretly, generously, regularly, and all that, but never with strings attached. Never with strings attached. And it breaks my heart when I see churches, and I mean, trust me, I've been all over in the last 8 years, and that get into conflicts, and one person will just leave, and they'll pull all their giving out as kind of a punitive statement, or they'll just quit giving. You know, there's an African proverb that says, when two elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. And I think oftentimes when people of power and greatness fight in the kingdom of God, churches, whole churches, just suffer. The sheep suffer. And so we need to be careful with how freely we let go of our tithes and offerings. The question is, whose kingdom am I investing in, mine or Yahweh's? And I think, you know, and this is probably pushing the envelope on this, but I think it's worth throwing out on the table to chew on. I think as congregations, my congregation at Altadena Valley, your congregation here at Brookwood and other churches that are represented, I think we need to be careful that we are giving to the kingdom with our giving as opposed to giving back to ourselves. You know, how much of our giving ends up being goods and services back to ourselves as opposed to goods and services to those outside the kingdom? You know, there are churches, there was a statement in the Birmingham News not too long ago where a seventh grade boy says, my church has everything I need, I don't need to go anyplace else. And so his entire focus was staying in that building. And I'm sorry, but I do not think that's the reason we exist. And I think we need to be careful here. We don't want our giving to become a means of control. Third one, Jesus said that true discipleship is characterized by following, not leading. Over and over and over in his teaching, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I say? And he says, respect those who labor over you in the Lord and hold them in highest regard as people who are going to have to give an account to God for the shepherding of your souls. There's, you know, be submitted to one another out of reverence to Christ. Paul says it again. Question, am I willing to be led or merely fed? Good question for us, particularly in an age of ubiquitous teaching. There is so much Bible teaching out there. I have no idea what podcast you've listened to before you came here on Wednesday. All right? I mean, you have the best of the best in your iPhone. All right? And if we're not careful, we'll become information junkies that aren't listening for the voice of God in the very teaching that we're taking in. You know, if you and I are really being taught by the Lord, then the teaching of God through the scriptures, through God's people, whoever they are, pastors and teachers and whatever, needs to be moving us someplace rather than just warming us where we are, all right? And so Jezebel, even though she's kind of a far-off person, I think there's a little bit of her in each of us. I know there is in me. And I would encourage you, in the quietness of your heart, we're going to pray here right now, but to just ponder this. You know, where in your life are you trying to maintain power and control?